possible Malaysian Polynesian culture. In any event, what is the problem with our North American Indians? Here we have a wide diversity of cultural attainment. Here we have also the indication that on this continent there was a gradual developing of a religious unity. The religious instincts of the North American Indians are surprisingly pure. Although these people were divided into comparatively small culture groups and that they had almost no contact outside of their own clans, these people developed inherently within their nature the most dignified, simple, but solemn concepts of religious value. In the entire American Indian complex, there emerges the archetypal, primordial, and inevitable priesthood. And this priesthood is a little difficult for us to restore from our own thinking because of poor terminology, which afflicts us here rather seriously also. The religious leader of the American Indian tribe we call the medicine man. It is a miserable term with no meaning that is comparable to the importance of his position. He was not one of these Indians that wandered around under servitude to some white vendor of patent medicine. The American Indian medicine priest, or whatever we want to call him, if anything we really call him, no one will know what we mean unless we say medicine priest, was actually a holy man. He was a saint. He was the hierarchy. He was the agent of deity upon earth for the small world in which he lived. For some reason, nearly all American Indian culture groups divided themselves into three orders. A pattern still followed in the caravans that go across the desert of Mongolia. The moment a caravan is formed, it elects three leaders. In every American Indian tribe, there were three leaders. One was the overchief, the supreme ruler of the tribe. The second was the war chief, who had to do with the protecting of the people against their enemies and against the emergencies of hazardous events and circumstances. And the third was the medicine chief. And the medicine chief was the priest who counseled. And it was rare indeed that a war chief or even the supreme chief of a tribe would make any important action without consulting the medicine priest. We know, for example, that when we see a Christian priest of the older days in his full canonicals, we find him robed. We find him, therefore, wearing, as was customary among most religions, the androgyne garments of both man and woman. In other words, the priests wore skirted vestments, and still in their robes, they wear garments that resemble a feminine attire. The American Indian medicine priest did the same thing. They said among those tribes that the reason for this was that he must be distinguished from other persons, so that if by a chance, the tribe was attacked by an enemy, the enemy would not accidentally kill the priest. He was supposed to be inviolate. He was not a warrior. He could never carry arms. But his counsel was considered to be as important to the vanquished and the vanquished, the victor, and he must not be injured in any combat. To do anything to him would be to bring down the wrath of heaven. The medicine priest, therefore, lived in a universe consisting, as he himself expresses it, and I have talked to several about it, I have known medicine priests, I've discussed their philosophy with them. And it is very simple. The universe is divided into three parts, corresponding to heaven, earth, and hell. This they knew long before any white man came here. The three regions of Chaldea, Babylon, and of the ancient Jewish writers. The upper supreme region, the overworld, was the abode of the Manigold, the great spirit. And who were the great spirits, the rulers of the world? The great spirits were the council of the Eternal Father. For over all peoples, for over all the world, there must finally be one Father. And these Indians did not worship a polytheistic concept essentially. They did not worship many gods any more than the Brahmin or the Buddhist does. They worshiped attributes. They worshiped beings who personified or exemplified various aspects of the supreme deity. This supreme deity they did not know, they did not understand. They admitted this. They could not know this deity according to its essence. They could only know it according to its manifestation. And the primary manifestations of this deity were other deities. Which had control over the sky and the stars and the sun and the moon. Therefore, these became the symbol of the supreme invisible cause of all life. Here also, somewhere far above the heaven, in some mysterious abode, was the great medicine lodge. And as you listen to an old Plains Indian telling you about the great medicine lodge, you cannot help but think of the mysterious legends of the Gobi Desert of Mongolia and of the Temple of Shambhala that rises in the midst of the everlasting sand. The medicine lodge of the Indian is the seat of universal government. The medicine lodge is the place where the elders, the great ones, the Manigolds who serve the eternal, sat in solemn council around the council fire. And each one smoked the calumet, or the pipe of peace, and the altar of incense unto the Most High. And here these grave and ancient ones labored forever that their children upon the earth might be led in righteousness and virtue. And it was one Indian that I talked to, as she explained it to me, smiled and said, "Of course we realize that this great medicine lodge and these great gods and this great Father who is beyond all, that these do not belong to us. They're not just Indians. This is the government of the whole world. We explain it for our own people. It's the Great One who sits above the Manigold, who is the invisible presence around the council fire. He is not any more Indian than he is anything else. He is life. He is the Great One. And wherever people are, anywhere on earth, he is also their same Father." You know, he got around to something we haven't caught up to yet. Namely, that all these things really are names for something that is universal. And out somewhere in the windy Dakotas, they realized this. But in the great cities of our churches, they do not know it yet. Perhaps the Dakotas give better air. And this heaven world is then guarded by a great being. And this great being is the Thunderbird. You see it. He is a kind of winged creature, perhaps like the cherubs that guarded the gates of Solomon's house. And this Thunderbird is the messenger. And every time he flashes his eyes, there is lightning. And when he rubs his great wings together, there is thunder. This is the mysterious messenger between heaven and earth. This is the Phoenix, the symbol of the regenerated human soul. This is the symbol of the truth in man, which is the bridge between earth and heaven. The second region of these Indians below the sky is the great expanse of nature itself. Here is the human world. Here is the earth that has been given to man, as old Chief Seattle said. We are the creatures who have been given the right to make this world beautiful. And most of all, as the Indian says, we have the right to leave this world as good as we found it. And we shall do no evil to it. We shall never injure it. We shall never exploit it. We shall not tear down its trees or corrupt its earth. We will not pollute its waters or its air. We will keep them pure for those who come after us. Because if those who came before us had not kept them pure, we could not live here today. So to keep this good earth pure is very important. And to realize that it was large enough for many tribes, for many herds of buffalo, so that all men might have enough, but never large enough for any man to waste anything. Never to kill for sport, never to injure for intent, but always to use wisely and lovingly. And if we must take life, to pray for that life, that it will forgive us for what we have had to do. Always thoughtfulness, always care, always prayer, always song to the sunrise, and always the strong song that is sung by the brave man when his time comes to die. This is the simple morality of a powerful culture group, a great people. And it was worked out upon the broad plain of the earth with its mountains and its valleys. And if there was a sacred place somewhere on this earth that corresponds to the Eastern concepts of some sacred island in the Gobina, this in the west was the place of the Redstone Pipe Quarry. Here it was that the pipe stem was quarried by all the tribes in order that they might make the pipe of peace, which is the symbol of their altar. And no matter how much war there might be among tribes or how evil men guarded or discarded each other, they must always enter into the place of the pipe quarry in brotherhood. For this was the place that the Great Spirit had set aside for men to make the symbols of their religion. And these must be guarded and served always with respect and fraternity. In the presence of their God, no man could raise their arms in violence. Then below the earth there was another world. A strange world that the Indian did not understand very well. But to him this underworld was not a place of punishment. The Indian had no place of punishment. I asked an Indian once why he didn't believe that there was a hell or place of punishment, as the missionary said. He smiled very frankly and said, "I don't think that we deserve to go to such a place. Therefore, why should we imagine that there is one? All Indians are good. Therefore, they don't worry about these things." It might be a little oversimplification, but it is still a pleasant thinking. Whereas in our way of life, nearly everyone either goes there or is sent there by somebody else. In fact, I have been told on fair authority that all the best people are there. But this other world, to the Indian, seems to be a sort of subterranean laboratory. For it is here that the grasses learn to grow. It is here that the great salt mother lives. It is under the earth that the spirits live who must make things to be green and the flowers to blossom. The Indian's afterworld is not really under the earth for the most part. It is in a kind of shadow twilight, somewhere between the earth and the sky. And the stars are the campfires of the brave warriors who have gone before. But they still have this idea of three worlds. A world of things beneath, where little creatures live, and where the Earth Mother dwelt, Mother Nature herself. And the servant of the earth mother was the serpent. Because the serpent went down into its hole in the ground and whispered to the earth mother the messages of men. So the serpent was the messenger to the earth, and the phoenix was the messenger to the sky. Of course, the phoenix is called the thunderbird. Now we have a threefold universe. And over this universe, great powers forever ruling. This is the same universe that we have in other parts of the world. Now, how were these initiation rituals thought of or practiced in these times? We may divide our American Aboriginal people into about three broad groups for our present purposes. Let's not forget there were many languages and probably nearly 200 essential culture groups north of the Mexican border here in this country. But for general purposes, we can divide them into about three. One was the Plains Indians, a completely nomadic people. They were a strong, vigorous people because they were constantly moving. Therefore, they never had to live at their own refuge, which became the basis of sickness among practically all ancient peoples. The moment they become stationary, the moment they settle into some abode, there are problems which the primitive mind could not cope with, and we also then have a lessening of vitality among the people. So the Plains Indians were among the most active and robust of our Indians. Then along the eastern seaboard, we had those Indians that had become involved in the Great League of the Iroquois Nation and were what we might almost call civilized Indians. Civilized in the sense that they already had practically all of the basic principles of self-government, of education, of commerce, of social equity, and things of that nature before the coming of the white man. Then we have in our southwest areas the Pueblo Indians, or the house-dwelling Indians, that formed comparatively permanent habitations and began to develop a much more intense social culture, particularly involving in problems of marriage across the Pueblo and things of that nature. In the Plains Indians, your religious rituals were either part of the daily life of the people, or as in the case of the Midi and of the Ojibwe Nation, temporary structures used for religious purposes similar to the tabernacle in the wilderness used for the Jewish people. Your Eastern Indian had his long house in which his entire religious and political philosophy could be evolved, and already had reached the point where the longhouse had become a kind of free university, and the youth of all the tribes shared in certain educational adventures in connection with learning the citizenship of their tribe. In the Pueblo Indian areas, culture developed very rapidly, and in the average Pueblo, a number of secret societies formally came into existence. These secret societies pertain to many subjects, of which perhaps the most important might be the fertility society, the war society, the societies which had to do with healing and medicine, and the societies which had to do with hunting. These were the ones that perhaps were the most versatile, and there were also, in most instances, one or more of these borderline societies which had already begun to intimidate and had begun to use what was termed magic for various objectionable ends. So that there was nearly always a society among these Pueblos regarded with fear by the other medicine or culture groups. These societies were certainly secret orders. And we know from the mysterious rituals involved in the snake dance and in other of their magical rituals, as Dr. Loomis pointed out, miracles of many kinds, things that would be equal to anything attributed to a Hindu magician, were performed in the chulas and in the holy places of these medicine societies. The priests were able to make the sun shine at midnight. They were able to levitate rocks. They were able to reproduce all kinds of phenomena, thunderstorms, and things of that nature within the structure of their lodge. And their dancing feather ceremonies are well known. Even today, in some of the Navajo reservations, you can see the dancing feather ceremonies. The magic was involved in most of the ritualism of these societies. Also, the great medicine societies performing the rituals such as the Obachai or the great chant, medicine chant, shooting chant, the deer chant, the use of the sand paintings, the development of the cult of the Kachinas, or the little gods that come down from the mountains. All of these things we find fairly well developed, particularly in the areas where the community-dwelling Pueblos meet the remnants of the old southwestern Plains Indians. In substance, we have much evidence of the religious ritual, and we have almost all of the basic values involved in the initiation rites of ancient times. Throughout the world, whether it be Greece or Rome, Egypt, India, or America, the initiation rites originally involved citizenship in the tribe, the nation, or the community. This citizenship had to be won by both boys and girls. And in most of the primitive ritualistic societies, both the boys and girls were initiated or had their own societies to carry them from childhood to maturity. Each group was instructed in the responsibilities of manhood or womanhood and initiated into a great deal of traditional knowledge that would be useful and necessary, and perhaps most of all, initiated into a way of life in harmony with the teachings that had descended to them orally from their ancestors or from the spirit. American Indian religion did involve a great deal of spiritism, a great deal of communion with nature, with a listening to the voices of the old and the trees and those who had gone before. The Indian did his vigil on every emergency of life. And each of these vigil experiences was like a small rite of initiation. The principal rite, however, depended for its performance upon circumstances. The lodge could either be built as the Midi was built, with its three rooms and its journey from west to east, with its hazards, with its symbols, and with its final communication of esoteric instruction and the bestowal of citizenship. Also, in this case, the bestowal of the medicine mystery, by which the person became, theoretically at least, capable of leading his life from his own soul. The Indian way of life was, as one has expressed it, a leading from within. He lived, for the most part, more or less isolated. He had very little contact with any except his own tribe. His entire solution to every emergency that arose had to be from within. So the whole religious mystery of the American Indian and of the Central American Indian also, in a more sophisticated manner, was this development of the leadership from within. Some of these Indians definitely did use narcotic herbs to create trances and dreams. In the ghost church cult, hypnosis was introduced. And in many other groups, magnetism, spiritism, and other beliefs and doctrines which we attribute to Europe or to other parts of the world were in use at a very early time. These forms of knowledge seemingly were innate. They were something that came to people as they grew or unfolded. They did not have to receive them by direct transmission from someone else, but perhaps they could have. This is the point that is still very difficult to clarify. So the Plains Indian that had no special medicine house and had perhaps no cultural tradition to build one, simply permitted the truth seeker to go out into the wilderness and pray. This perhaps is the oldest church of God that we know, through prayer and fasting. And he went out and he created his little circle of prayer sticks, and he lit his pipe, and he burned it to the four corners of the world, and he seated himself upon the good earth and sat almost in a Buddha-like posture, and there simply waited with his hands loosely in his lap, his eyes nearly closed, his head bent, sitting alone under the stars, waiting to hear the voice of his God. And his prayer was always the same, "Father, show me the way." And he would listen, and perhaps he would hear nothing. But if he did not, he would continue his vigil, day after day, night after night. He would fast and pray, though sometimes he collapsed with exhaustion. Perhaps it was only then that the vision came. But those who seemingly were more quick of vision often saw or heard almost immediately. And they lived and they accepted. Whatever they heard, that they did. There was no question, no debate, no self-interest to impose itself. Whatever was whispered to them out of the night, that they did, with a full heart and a complete confidence. One of the great medicine priests of the Ojibwe nation once described how he learned to be a healer. He admitted very definitely that this office of medicine priest was hereditary to a degree, but very often there was no one to carry it on. There was no schooling in it. Perhaps the young man observed the common remedies of his tribe, or watched a medicine priest at work, or learned some of the songs, or tried to copy some of the remedies. But there was no formal instruction. If you went out into the night and sat alone, when the time came for you to do the vigil of manhood, which was to tell you what you were to do with your life, you had to be guided by vision. No Indian would ever decide what his career is going to be, and nor would his relatives and friends. No one would say, "My son is going to be a medicine priest," and perhaps do everything possible by conspiracy to make this possible. Such a thing was not done among these people. A young man went out. If he was a very thoughtful, quiet, mystic type of young man, it might be rumored among the tribe that he probably would be a priest. But this was only if the gods finally sanctioned. And when he went out and did his vigil alone, he waited for the spirit to come and tell him. And if he beheld in his vigil the form of a thunderbird, if the thunderbird appeared to him, with its great glistening eyes and its thundering wings, he knew then that he was ordained to be a priest, for he was under the wing of the great bird of heaven. If such was the case, then it was his task now to become a healer of his people. He couldn't go to school. There was no college, no American Medical Association, to which we all give thanks, and there was nothing of his kind to help him. He didn't even know one weed from another. All he knew was that heaven had intended that he become a healer. Therefore, it was heaven that must show him the way. And as this man explained to me, he began, and various people came to him, and they were sick, and the old medicine priest had died, and he had naturally become his successor. He had never studied with him, but he had respected him. And so a man came and said, "I have a great pain in my side. What shall I do?" Another one said, "I have a piece of hurt." The third says, "I have an abscess." A fourth has broken his leg in a fall from a horse. Another one has been injured. fighting a bear, another has been stung by a serpent. All of these people come one after the other through the years. The sick, the old, the infant, the mother to bear her child, everything comes to the old medicine tree. And he has never been to school, and he's never had a lesson in anything. What can he do? As this one told me, there's only one thing you can do. Pray. Be silent. Hold out your hands to the sky and tell the sky to use them. We cannot use them. But he said, always when I pray, something comes. Always a voice seems to lead me. Always my eye turns to something. I am shown the way. So I go out and I look for an herb. And I cannot tell one herb from another. And he says, I sit there quietly looking over the land. And I say, Father, show me the herb that will bring help. And he says, as I watch, a light shines from that herb. And I go and get it, and I make the medicine, and the person gets well. This is the beginning. This is the way I think that probably all arts and sciences began. A very primitive searching in which man, because he possessed a peculiar kind of consciousness, was able by degrees to reveal to himself and through himself to others the innumerable mysteries of life as these mysteries unfold. So the medicine priest received his initiation out alone in vigil. He received it every day as he labored. And he lived always in this great lodge of heaven itself. Schoolcraft, in his great work on the American Indian, describes how some of these medicine priests, in their vision, actually believed that they were able to leave their bodies and go to the great lodge in the sky where the old ones, the great rulers of the world, were, and that they might even be asked to sit in a humble place dear to these wise ones and receive the great instruction. Now, if a priest, the medicine priest, was called out of his body and the great ones spoke to him, they told him the great magic. They told him the power to control the elements in the stars. They told him how to see at great distances. They told him how to travel invisibly from place to place. They told him all the secrets of the great magic of the great medicine lodge. This one then returned to his people, a very high priest, invested with all miracles and wonders, and gained a great reputation. Now we might also say that this all sounds like a lot of gibberish, that anyone could pretend these things, but as my old Navajo friend, the Hustine Kla, used to say, it isn't so easy to do that when you live in a community of 70 families for 70 years. Who are you going to fool? We can't fool everybody all the time. We can't make up stories that never amount to anything. You can't guess and always be right. And if anything goes wrong and somebody dies because you've made a bad guess, you can't move into another community and start over again. You start, you believe, you carry the whole burden. You must either prove yourself or be disproved. And you are living forever under the watchful eyes of people who never forget. They know what you have said. You can never take it back. They know what you have promised. You can never fail. And to be sufficiently successful to hold an honored and esteemed reputation in this little family of people that has no other doctor, no other lawyer, no other priest, no other confidant, to do this and to do it without breaking the code, holding the personal respect and admiration as well as the professional respect of these people. You cannot just be a charlatan. You cannot just make up stories. You have to be right. If you say the buffalo are 3 days' journey to the north, the buffalo had better be there. If you say that this individual will get well, he had better get well. Maybe once in a while you could be wrong. Even the stars in the sky seem to make mistakes. But you cannot make too many. You must be right most of the time. So that whatever comes to these people comes as it does to the, in the mysteries and initiations of the Cherokee Indians, where there are many very interesting rites and ceremonies. But always these mysteries and initiations have to do with bridging across from one world to another. They are all man searching for that which some way in his own heart he knows exists. And that is a tremendous living spiritual force. This is the very source and substance of the mana and of the orenda. Without these terms, without these beliefs, this great complex of people could not have carried on their growth through the centuries. They could not have followed faithfully in the ways of their fathers. They could not have learned the great arts that they knew, some of which we are trying to rescue before these people become extinct. Or perhaps not because they die out physically, but because their culture dies out under the ridicule of stupid people. But actually, the old ways had something. And these old ways are deep and long. We have had our present beliefs for 500 years. We lived under the old way perhaps for 5 million years. Down inside of each of us, the old way is still there. And it is this old way forever coming through that brings mysticism into focus in a materialistic age. It is this old way which is the reason why materialism is a mood, but it can never finally dominate it. Because within us is this contact inwardly with the universe. Now we said in our discussion of the Greek mysteries that the great part of the mystery ritual was finally the communication of this inner spiritual reality. That man had to have a mystical experience by which he realized his victory over death. I think the same was exactly the case in the Western Hemisphere. That these mysteries, as practiced here, led, as in other regions, to the final state of conscious existence apart from body. Schoolcraft gives us another important reference, and of course he is the outstanding authority on North American Indians. He says that one of the functions of the medicine priest was to go with the dead into the other world. Here we are back in the Egyptian ritual of the dead. Therefore, when a person was dying in one of the Western tribes, the medicine priest was called in. And if according to his own insight and understanding, the time had come for this soul to depart, he sat quietly in prayer or meditation beside the dying person, as the Tibetan Lama does in the ritual of the Bardo. And when the death comes, the medicine priest goes into a trance. And according to the records that were preserved, the stories they told, this priest in trance leaves his body and stands beside the spirit of the deceased person. He then takes his hand very gently and with great kindliness and leads him through the night to up a strange trail that is gray and mysterious, until finally he comes to a beautiful valley with a soft, radiant light. And here the Indian finds the village in the sky that is like the one he left behind. And here he is welcomed by those who went before him and comes as an honored friend and guest into a new region of life. Schoolcraft also points out that many of these tribes believed in reincarnation. Among others that had this belief, by the way, were the primitive Indians of California. So, here we have the guide guiding the soul of the Egyptian dead through the mysteries leading to the Amentet. The Indian was not so sophisticated, therefore he did not have a judgment of the soul. The Indian took it for granted that he did the best he could. He took it for granted that he was neither better nor worse than the average. He did not believe that his God demanded perfection of a creature whom he had never taught. He did not believe that God required virtues that the human being had no opportunity to learn or no way of applying. The Indian lived naturally. His philosophy was very simple. He says, I will be honest. I will be honorable in my dealings with everyone. I will do good whenever I can. I will never turn a hungry person from my door. I will do none of the things that it seems to me are not right. And therefore, when my time comes, I shall sing my death song proudly and go forth to my father. I will go to the great Indian who understands Indian. I will also, perhaps through him, ultimately go on and on to a still greater being who understands all men. But the Indian said, whatever the old ones are that sit in my medicine lodge in the sky, they know me. They know my heart. They do not have to ask me questions. They do not have to try to decide what kind of a man I am. They know. They know my problems. And if I know in my heart that I have done as well as I could, I may go proudly into the house of my father. All of this has a lot of mysticism in it, but it is not quite as complicated and ritualistic as in some of the other philosophies that we may consider. But out of these primitive beliefs and out of this primitive thinking, I think we can trace that which in the Aztec and Maya culture complex gradually took form. We no longer the vigil alone in the night, now the vigil alone in the great sanctuary in the wilderness. No longer the individual entirely alone, learning from the stars and from the earth, but now going into the presence of a priestly college that perhaps originated as he had previously experienced. But now this knowledge was in books. The records of the herbs and simples were known. The simple principles of surgery and dentistry were already well understood in Central America. The Incas of Peru inlaid teeth with precious stones. Many of these people performed successful trepanning on the brain, and the patient lived. We know this from the condition of the skull. So these people knew many things. But I'm sure that by the time they reached the cultural level of the Maya, it was not just by going out and sitting in the forest. Now it was a case where all this forest wisdom that had all begun the same way, now had begun to be gathered, to be put in tablets and in written form, and to be traced in the enduring memories of orders of priests. So now the neophyte received the whole instruction of his people. But he also had to test himself and prove himself. And it was undoubtedly part of his discipline that if he wished to go on from education to theurgy, that he would have to likewise be initiated, would have to again pass through the fasting and all these higher rites that ultimately opened the inner consciousness and made it possible for him again to sit with the masters of his lodge in the great house in the sky. All of the mysteries had the same grand pageantry, and also they all had all the same wonderful simplicity in a way, because they were all aimed just as Zen is aimed, toward a direct experience of something. No more just theorizing, no more just remembering, but something that happens to the person whereby he opens his own consciousness to receive the great instruction. In the Eastern Seaboard and the mysteries of the Long House, the initiation of the child involved this element of a render that we have mentioned before. In this type of initiation, the young person was brought into a circle of his elders whom he regarded and admired, his living elders, and here in solemn and most systematic manner, he was told the story of his people. He was told of the honors that had gone before, of the bravery of his ancestors, of how good men had sacrificed their lives and their happiness in order that the tribe might survive, and how he owed to all of these who had gone before him a certain gratitude, for they had suffered and labored and died that he might live, that he might have a better kind of life. And therefore into his mind and into his heart must also flow the high resolution, the noble dedication, the commitment to the common good that was the virtue of his people. He must be like the best of the old one and the true one. He must accept his citizenship as a great responsibility, as the proof of his own manhood, for it was his duty to guard the rights of his people, to guard their liberties, and also to guard his own nature against selfishness or anything that would destroy this beautiful chain of remembrance by which all that is good now is bound to the dreams of those who have gone before, and also in a mysterious way is born and bound to the dreams of all who will come after. So in this way, the young person received something. He felt moving into his own heart the tremendous wealth and strength of his people. He realized the privilege of being a man, the wonderful opportunity to be a true hero, to give of all of himself, to do the very best that he could ever to bring honor. And as this spirit flared up in glory within himself until he knew that he had a destiny that was worthy of a man, then the old one said, the Orenda had come. The mystery of consciousness had opened in this person. This young individual now saw his destiny, saw his work, recognized his place, knew that he was desperately needed, knew how much there was to be done. And in those moments of knowing, he was initiated. He became one of his people, to live with them, to labor for them, and to die with them. These were his duties. And to realize this was to have the spirit moving strong within him. Out of these situations, I believe the mysterious will change. And I think they developed through several stages on our Western Hemisphere, that climaxing in the longhouse of the five nations of the Iroquois, or perhaps in the mysterious jungle temples of Chibalba. Regardless, it is part of the same mystery tradition that we trace in other parts of the world. Well, I guess our time is up, so we'll try it again next week.